This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى مقومًا ولا أذًى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories this hour. Palestinian Islamic Jihad targets Israeli cities with a volley of rockets hours after the deadly bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Several countries as well as resistance groups across the region react to Israel's latest bloodshed in Gaza, warning the regime against further provocations. Plus, China urges the United States to stop escalating tensions over Taiwan following House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's controversial visit to the island. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. The situation is rapidly escalating in the Gaza Strip after Israeli airstrikes there. Palestinian resistance forces have launched retaliatory strikes with a barrage of rockets. The attacks sounded sirens in the southern Israeli cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says it has fired more than 100 rockets at regime-held territories. It says this is an initial response to Israel's earlier airstrikes. The onslaught on Gaza has so far killed 10 people, including a 5-year-old girl and a resistance commander. Nearly 100 people have also been injured. Palestinian resistance groups have called for unity in the face of the Israeli aggression. They have ruled out any truce, saying the regime must fully pay the price for its actions. Condemnations are pouring in and following Israel's deadly airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the attacks as criminal, provocative, and adventurous. Nasser Kanani has warned Israel of the consequences of his aggression. Kanani says Palestinians have the right to defend themselves against what he called the apartheid regime's terrorist measures. Turkey also strongly condemned the air raids. Ankara said it is unacceptable to kill civilians in attacks. Yemen's National Salvation Government and Ansarullah movement condemned the Israeli airstrikes as well. Ansarullah also reaffirmed Palestinians' right to respond to Israeli aggression. Qatar, Jordan, Algeria, Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Iraq's Kataib Hezbollah group, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation also condemned the attacks. Now, for the latest updates with regard to the latest Israeli airstrikes on Gaza Strip, Ashraf Shannon is with us. Ashraf, please give us the latest updates in Khan Yunis.
Yes, Amid, not so long ago, Israeli fighter jets fired several rockets towards a farmland east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, killing a young man and injuring several others. This brings the death toll from since yesterday to 11, and more than 100 people have been injured. Yesterday afternoon, the Israeli regime fighter jets attacked Gaza. They started their onslaught, the recent onslaught, by assassinating a senior member of the Islamic Jihad military wing, the Al-Quds brigades. And they did that by targeting a huge apartment building in Gaza City, housing nearly 100 families in it. Heavy damage was sustained to the apartment below and above the one that was targeted by the Israeli regime fighter jets. And also several airstrikes took place against northern, central, and southern Gaza. The Palestinian resistance groups, mainly the Islamic Jihad, retaliated by firing volleys of rockets, barrage of rockets against the Israeli regime. The Islamic Jihad said that it fired at least 100 rockets. And the retaliatory rocket fire continues to take place as we speak, Omid, while Palestinians in Gaza have shown unity, especially among the resistance groups who are responding to these Israeli attacks through the joint military operations room.
Yeah, Ashraf, so that... this latest person who has lost his life will increase the number of people who were killed as a result of Israeli airstrikes to 11 up to now. Now, many Israelis living near Gaza have spent the night in bomb shelters after the regime rained down bombs on the strip in an unprovoked attack. Now, what has occupied observers' mind is, why Israel is escalating tensions with Palestinians once again, and is this the lead up to a fresh large-scale conflict?
Well, everyone here hopes that no large-scale conflict will take place, but many here believe that acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid is stretching his muscles and possibly using the attack on Gaza and the assassination of a top Islamic Jihad commander as part of his party's elections campaign in October, where Israel will be the Israeli regime will be holding elections.
And finally, just days ago, Secretary General of Islamic Jihad Ziad Nakhala said Israel has today found itself encircled from all directions by the resistance axis. And now we see the resistance front across the region reacting in unison to this latest attack from Hezbollah's resistance movement, Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, to Iraq's Qatar Hezbollah, and also Yemen's Ansarullah movement. What is the message for Israel?
Well, I believe the message for Israel that the resistance axis is united and is growing stronger and will not be scared by Israeli attacks, and it shows that the resistance axis is powerful, whether in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, or in Yemen.
Ashraf, thank you so much for joining us, and please stay safe. That was Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza City. Iran says it will rigorously enforce its red lines during the Vienna talks aimed at the revival of the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also underscored the country's right to enjoy the economic benefits of the accord known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He said the Iranian negotiation team pays serious attention to this issue, as well as the country's right to safeguarding its peaceful nuclear capability, technology, and know-how. Meanwhile, the Russian foreign minister has described Iran's position on the revival of the JCPOA as absolutely legitimate.
Now, the point is that the Americans are trying to make an altered plan a subject matter of a new agreement, while the Iranians insist on the accord approved in 2015. I believe that Iran's position is absolutely legitimate. The Americans withdrew from the plan, which all the other parties and the Americans themselves had once approved. Considering that Washington tried to dismantle it, Washington should simply recall its position and return to the original accord. That is the problem now.
Lavrov said Russia's position on the revival of the JCPOA remains unchanged. He added that Moscow wants the accord to be restored to its original form that was approved by the UN Security Council with no amendments or exemptions. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April last year in an attempt to revive the deal. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator is currently in the Austrian capital for a new round of diplomacy. Ali Bogherikeni has held talks with the European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora and Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov since his arrival in Austria on Thursday. Mohammad Marandi is an advisor to Iran's negotiating team in Vienna. He believes it is still too soon to be either optimistic or pessimistic about the outcome of the JCPOA revival talks. Have a listen.
I think we should not be pessimistic, nor should we be optimistic. There has been progress. If you read between the lines from what European officials are saying, it's quite clear that they have adjusted their position on multiple issues. So that means there is progress. However, we still haven't reached the end of the negotiations. We are not quite sure. We're not sure at all whether the Europeans and the Americans, especially the Americans, will accept Iran's conditions. As I said, there is some movement on the Western side, which is a plus. But as they have been saying for a very long period of time, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So we're still going to have to wait a bit to see what happens.
8 civilians are dead in a bombing that hit a neighborhood in the western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Police say 18 people were also injured when the device attached to a handcart detonated in a shopping center. The marketplace is located in a residential area mostly inhabited by the Shia Hazaras. The Taliban government says the bombing was the work of the enemies of Islam in the country. That's after Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the attack. Iran has also strongly condemned the bombing that hit during the Muslim calendar month of Muharram. It called on the Taliban to make further security arrangements for the morning gatherings held during the month every year. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to continue his efforts to overthrow what he calls the country's U.S.-backed imported government. He has demanded that the Pakistani Chief Election Commissioner step down to pave the way for holding fresh elections in the country. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more in this report from Islamabad.
Hundreds of supporters and lawmakers of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf party has filled the streets of the capital Islamabad in a show of support for the ousted premier Imran Khan. They marched in Islamabad's red zone to protest the recent verdict issued by the country's electoral body that declared Khan's party has received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities.
The charged protesters are not only demanding that Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and his cabinet step down, but also warning the United States to stay away from Pakistan's internal affairs.
The demonstrators criticized the role of Washington in Pakistan's politics, saying they are seeking independent foreign policy in Pakistan.
What they are doing to us with the drone attacks, the army men who are killed in our country, they just went for the, you know, the relief work. And after that, the plane was crashed. It is just, I would say, it's you know, they're intervening in our country.
With the USA, some black sheep from Pakistan, they were also involved into all this procedure. That's why the real hero of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has to resign from his office. And now the question is why? Because Imran Khan, he said absolutely not to all their illegal and to all their unfair demands.
While addressing the protesters, Khan underlined that a fresh election is the only way to get rid of what he called the puppet regime.
The U.S. staged a scripted drama for their own benefit in Pakistan and brought like-minded people into the power to control Pakistan and its foreign policy. So fresh elections are the only solution to get rid of this government.
On the other hand, The Pakistani government has filed a disqualification reference in Election Commission against Imran Khan. The government demands that the electoral body impose a lifetime ban on former premier as well as his political party. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
China's foreign minister has urged the United States not to escalate the tensions between the two countries, which have soared to new highs over the flashpoint island of Taiwan.
America's habit is to create a problem and then use this problem to achieve its goals. But this approach will not work with China. We want to issue a warning to the U.S. not to act rashly and not to create a bigger crisis. The U.S. says China has changed the status quo of the Taiwan Strait situation. This is false and smearing. What is the Taiwan Strait status quo? Taiwan is part of China. It is never a country. There is only one China. This has been the case since ancient times.
China's foreign ministry also slammed U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. The ministry said her trip interfered with China's internal affairs and undermined the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Beijing has rolled out countermeasures against the U.S., which include ending military talks and meetings between Chinese and U.S. defense leaders. The new measures were announced hours after Beijing imposed sanctions on Pelosi. This as China held the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan, which the U.S. has condemned.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
Meanwhile, Pelosi has reaffirmed Washington's support for the island, adding that the U.S. will not allow China to isolate Taiwan. The House Speaker, however, explained her trip was not aimed at changing the status quo on the island. Relations between China and the U.S. have soured over a host of issues, including trade, the South China Sea, and Taiwan. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory and has already warned Washington against playing with fire, vowing to punish those who anger Beijing.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and intellectuals have spoken about Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. In a few episodes, we have discussed the views of Sunni scholars and Sunni thinkers on this grand personality and his unmatched movement. Stay tuned for the fourth and concluding part of this discussion. Maulana Muhammad Shafi Deobandi was a Sunni scholar and poet from the Deoband city of Pakistan. Deobandi was born in 1897 and graduated from Darul Uloom, or the House of Sciences, of his city in 1917. Then he started teaching at the same center as the Grand Mufti. This Pakistani Mufti has authored a book on the Epic of Ashura and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, under the title of Martyr of Karbala. What distinguishes this book from others is the foreword of the book, where he makes it clear that he has collected the content of the book from accurate and documented narrations. Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi, in his book, writes on the role of the wicked rebel Muawiyah, son of Abu Sufyan, in martyrdom of the Holy Prophet's dear grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Abdullah, son of Muslim, wrote a letter for Yazid. He said that Imam Hussein's cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil, had come to Kufa to gather people's allegiance for the Imam. Then he continues, "If you need Kufa and wish to have the city in your control, immediately send a powerful and able man to put your rules into action, as the current ruler, Nu'man, son of Bashir, is weak." Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi continues, "Other persons like Amara, son of Walid, and Amr, son of Sa'id, wrote and sent similar letters to Muawiyah's libertine son, Yazid. Yazid, having received those letters, instantly asked for special advisor of his father, Sarjun, son of Mansur, and consulted with him on the circumstances of Kufa. The latter suggested to him to send Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, to become the ruler of Kufa. Yazid was not in good terms with the son of Ziyad. Thus, Sarjun told him, "If Muawiyah was here and asking you to do something, would you do it?" Yazid answered, "Surely I would have done it." Then Sarjun took out a letter from the rebel Muawiyah in which he had appointed Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, as the ruler of Kufa. Therefore Yazid accepted and appointed the son of Ziyad, Ubaidullah, as the ruler of both Kufa and Basra. He stressed that he should leave for Kufa as soon as getting the letter. He ordered him to arrest and kill Imam Hussein's cousin and emissary, Muslim ibn Aqil. Sunni Muslims consider Imam Hussein's martyrdom as a picture of valor, self-sacrifice, defense of truth, and fighting oppressors. Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi writes in his book on Imam Hussein's valor in the heat of the battle, "Shemr, son of Zeljoshan, attacked Imam Hussein with 10 men." Dear listeners, what many historians and narrators have said is that hundreds of top commanders of the enemy assaulted the Imam, and the Imam killed all of them. Yet, Muhammad Shafi Diobandi has written only 10 men attacked him. He continues, "The Imam, in spite of innumerable wounds and excessive thirst, fought them bravely. Historians have written that this event was unique, as Hussein ibn Ali, peace be upon him, fought steadfastly and courageously, despite having sustained too many injuries. Wherever Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, turned, the enemy would immediately escape. Thus, Shemr understood that Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, could not be killed except through besieging him and attacking from every side. So the troops attacked him ferociously and martyred the grandson of the Holy Prophet."
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yemeni men, ominous shadows.
Part 1.
The war in Yemen was in fact a combination of three battles. Everyone knows about the first war, the resistance by the Ansarullah against the Saudi invasion and the forces supported by Mohammed bin Salman. The second war is a conflict between the Houthis and the Al-Qaeda militants who are supported by Riyadh to make Yemen insecure and crush the Houthis who are Zaydi Shias. But we've heard less often about Yemen's third war. On April 27, 2017, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, Mohammed bin Salman's crony, who claims to be Yemen's president, deposed Idarus Qasim Abdul Aziz Al Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, the capital of former South Yemen. The reason for his dismissal was the vast relationship between Zubaydi and a tiny nation on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf, the newly established United Arab Emirates. After the dismissal, a large crowd of Zubaydi supporters took to the streets. The supporters were mobilized by the UAE. Hadi was informed through Saudi agents that the United Arab Emirates was behind all of this. It wasn't the first time that Hadi and bin Salman were informed of the UAE's spontaneous measures. Last winter, Hadi, who usually resided in Saudi Arabia, decided to visit Aden, that was the largest city controlled by the Saudi-backed militants. When Hadi's plane approached the airport in Yemen, as a rule of thumb, it requested to land, but the airport in Yemen didn't allow the plane to land. So the plane had to land kilometers away on the island of Socotra. Hadi was enraged. He fired the director of the airport and ordered the forces under his command to besiege the airport. The UAE-backed forces opened fire at Hadi's forces at the airport. So the rift that everyone was already aware of opened wider. The rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia,
بين الإمارات والسعودية.
Bin Salman had sensed the danger and initially decided to act as the big brother and impartial mediator to forge reconciliation between Hadi and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, who was also the UAE's deputy commander-in-chief, Bin Zayed. 2 weeks later, Hadi left for Abu Dhabi, but talks took only 10 minutes. Bin Zayed reminded Hadi that the UAE has paid a lot of money to liberate Yemen. And Hadi told bin Zayed that the UAE acts like an occupying power in Yemen, not a country that's deployed forces to liberate it. Hadi decided to fire the UAE cronies in his government, which itself was designated by Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman was supposed to teach the UAE a lesson and force them to support Saudi policies and stop going their own way. Finally, on April 27, 2017, bin Salman gave Hadi the green light to punish the UAE. Adarus Qasim al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, and Hani Ali bin Breik, one of the ministers of Hadi's cabinet, were fired. The UAE reacted quickly. A massive protest in Aden. This time, the groups in Aden sought independence in South Yemen.
انقسمت اليمن على مدى عقود الى قسمين شمالي وجنوبي.
For decades, Yemen had been divided into two northern and southern parts. North Yemen, whose capital was Sana'a, gained independence from the Ottoman Empire in the last year of the First World War in 1918. But South Yemen remained under British control for several decades later. Aden, the capital of South Yemen, was an important port for UK colonial ships in West and South Asia for decades. 1969, South Yemen became independent. Twenty-one years later, in 1990, South Yemen became united with North Yemen. 30 years later, the unity was about to collapse due to the UAE's meddlesome policies. After the war in Yemen, Hadi forces backed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia managed to occupy parts of what was called South Yemen in the past. North Yemen was still in control of Ansarullah forces, so South Yemen had turned into the only shelter for the Saudi-backed rebels. After the independence-seeking move in South Yemen, the bastion would be lost. Hadi was concerned. Bin Salman was even more concerned. Hadi's government was a bin Salman puppet and was supported by the U.S. ambassador. After the differences intensified, bin Salman realized that the UAE's offensive move wasn't against Hadi, but him. The UAE challenged Hadi's rule over Aden, even though it knew bin Salman backed him. It was a proclamation of war against bin Salman.
اتخذ محمد بن سلمان الخطوة التالية إذ أعلنها جهارا بأنه يقف
بن سلمان took the next step. He openly announced that he supports all decisions, measures and arrangements by the Hadi government to restore security in Yemen. It means that Saudi Arabia allowed Hadi to crush the militants in South Yemen who were backed by the UAE. The STC, or the Southern Transitional Council, is a Yemeni group that wants to see South Yemen as an independent country in the international community. It meant that Hadi would lose his only base and bin Salman's war in Yemen would practically end in failure. The STC was formed on the 14th of May, 2017. Its leader was Idrus al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, who had just been deposed by Hadi. After receiving the thumbs up from bin Salman, Hadi immediately announced that the council was illegal, but the STC isn't just a political group. Its military branch, called the Security Belt Forces, was formed, a 15,000-strong militia group entirely funded by the United Arab Emirates. In January 2018, Zubaydi announced that the process of deposing Hadi in Aden had started. Now, a new front has opened for MBS. On January 28th, all administrative buildings of Hadi's government in Aden were captured. The SDC controlled the city. The spring in 2018 started while the Emiratis made another new move. Babu Mandab. It means the gate of wailing. The myth has it that once a battle took place in the region and the fugitives who passed from the strait cried over those who were killed, but some others say that the name has its roots in the slavery era when the strait was a crossing point for the ships that transferred slaves from Africa. So the name the Strait of Wailing was chosen because of the crying of the slaves. Beyond the world of mythology, the situation hasn't changed that much. Wailing can still be heard from the strait. This is part of Africa called the Horn of Africa. After Eritrea split from Ethiopia, it was a hot spot for long battles for several decades. On the other side of the strait, Yemen is located, another hot spot for war. But the emergence of a new economic power changed the equation. China has been in the region for a while, and in order to get closer to the strait, it has signed trade contracts with Ethiopia near the strait. China has established a special economic zone in Ethiopia. It manufactures electrical appliances, construction material, agricultural machinery, steel, and other metals in the zone. Even the small country near the strait, namely Djibouti, signed a contract with China. Now, based on that contract, China established a naval base near Djibouti. The base fights sea pirates. The beginning of the threat to the Western interests in Bab el-Mandab Strait. After China came to the region, everyone got worried. Now, the Persian Gulf Arab states consider control over the strait a major part of security in their region. Soon, Turks, Japanese, and Americans showed up for trade and gaining a foothold on the African side of the strait. Let's take a look at the strait once again. Sea transportation is the most important way of transit for goods and energy all across the world. If the strait is shut, the route becomes several times longer and the costs will also increase. As you can see, all ways lead to this strait. So, many countries showed up one after the other to invest on the African side. World economy was going through transformation. Economies like China, India, and Brazil were now on the list of top 10 countries with the highest GDP. These countries have young populations. The old rich countries, except for the U.S., are suffering from aging crisis. Their populations are getting older. It means the balance will gradually tip in favor of consumption and against production. Cheap labor force and new markets are the dream of the new capitalist system. In recent years, the economic growth of the countries to the south of Bab-el-Mandab Strait boosted because of the presence of foreign investors. Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Eritrea experienced an economic growth of 5 to 9%. The growth did not exist in these countries during the past years. Something new was happening. Arab countries also showed up. From 2000, the investment of Arabs started in the Horn of Africa. It was mainly in Sudan and Ethiopia that reached $13 billion as of 2017. That was a time when the war in Yemen started with Saudi, U.S., and UAE meddlesome policies. The problem in the north of the strait should have been resolved. Let's review the developments in the strait in recent years. A civil war broke out in Somalia, Eritrea split from Ethiopia, Sudan was divided into northern and southern parts, and now it was Yemen's turn. All of these developments took place near the vital strait. Yes, reviving the issue of North and South Yemen, or the Southern Transitional Council, was supported by the UAE. It didn't stop with supporting the secessionist group and personally got involved. This is Socotra Island, Yemen's large and strategic island in the Indian Ocean, en route to Bab-el-Mandab. Any country that takes control of the island will practically control one of the most strategic routes in the world with heavy traffic. The Asma Island belongs to Yemen, but it's been abandoned for a while because of the war. Only a UAE military unit stays on the island. In the 2015 tempest, the island was badly damaged. The island's infrastructure was demolished. The war in mainland Yemen was ongoing, and no group could help the island. The Emiratis took advantage of the situation. UAE aid and rescue forces were the first ones to arrive on the island. Afterwards, the military forces showed up. They had come to train the militia group affiliated with them on Socotra. It was the same strategy they devised for Aden and South Yemen. Hence, the UAE gained a foothold in the strategic island. Abu Rabu Mansour Hadi's vice president, Ahmed Obeid bin Daghir announced the occupation of Socotra port and airport by the United Arab Emirates was a violation of Yemen's national sovereignty. The UAE knew that it has the upper hand. In secret meetings with the U.S. and Zionist officials, it agreed to normalize ties with the occupying regime. For the UAE, the normalization would help it get closer to Washington, so it believed that in the developments in Yemen, it would have the upper hand. The UAE handed Socotra over to the STC, but considering the relations between Zionist regime and the UAE and the STC, we could say that South Yemen and Socotra were in the occupying regime's clutches. To some extent, things went as the UAE had planned. Donald Trump didn't want to disturb the Abu Dhabi-Tel Aviv normalization, so he didn't side with Israel, and he only said the two sides need to reduce tensions. The young Saudi ruler now faced a bitter reality. He cannot even control his ally, namely the tiny nation of the UAE. In fact, the UAE had entered the Yemen war with the goal of economic development. The carnage of people in Yemen, famine, disease, hunger, and ruining all welfare indices were the costs that the Yemenis had to pay so the UAE could progress. But the loser of the game was bin Salman. He never realized that he was ditched by his closest ally in the region. In 2019, when Hadi's forces moved to Aden for a massive attack, UAE fighter jets launched a blitzkrieg on Hadi forces on August 29, 2019. It was a complicated situation. For the Houthis and Ansarullah, the UAE was like Saudi Arabia as they both targeted civilians. But at the same time, the Emiratis moved against Hadi, who was appointed by Riyadh. The situation put bin Salman in a tough spot. On April 26, 2020, the situation became more complicated for Hadi and bin Salman. The STC claimed autonomy.
In the limelight.
What is happening today in Masafer Yatar is just as fundamentally a part of this phenomena as the ongoing repression and resistance in Sheikh Jarrah in Gaza and beyond, says Omar Zahza, member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, in an article published under the heading Masafer Yatar evictions enabled by British-born judge. Stay tuned for more. To Palestinians and their supporters, it is known as Masafer Yatar. To the fake regime of Israel, and in keeping with the A septic detachment common to colonial regimes, it has been firing Zone 918 since 1981, when then-Agriculture Minister Ariel Sharon decided on that designation explicitly in order to force out the area's residents. Located in South Al-Khalil Hills, the area spans 12 Palestinian villages with nearly 2,800 residents whose livelihoods depend mainly on farming. Agricultural communities have lived on the 8,600 acres of land and called it home for generations. In 1999, the Zionist regime's army expelled 700 residents of the area, though they were able to return pending a final ruling. This decades-old attempt at ethnic cleansing is now entering a crucial phase. On May 4th, the Zionist regime's High Court issued a ruling enabling the expulsion of nearly 1,200 Palestinians from the area, including 500 children, a decision the UN said may amount to a war crime. On June 1st, the Zionist regime forces demolished two homes in Khirbet al-Fakhit and two storage sheds, as well as two homes in Khirbet Markaz, both part of Masafer Yatar. In all, 21 people, including 9 minors, were displaced. 11 homes and workshops have been demolished since May ruling. Masafer Yatta puts on full naked display the cynical, oppressive, and overall colonial character of the ruling issued by David Mentz, a judge who lives in an illegal settlement in the West Bank, and the Zionist regime's actions. In the words of Nidal Yunus, head of the Masafer Yatta Village Council, the ruling was simply racist. The court decision is a racist decision taken by a settler judge. We have been fighting with Israel in the courts for the last 22 years, and it took this judge 5 minutes to destroy the lives of 12 villages and the people who are dependent on the land, unquote. Yunus regards the ruling as a continuation of the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Yunus has said, history repeats itself, Nakba after Nakba. This helped throw into focus how a major injustice has become entrenched. British-born Mentz wields total life divesting power over those who are indigenous to the land. Through and through, the Zionist regime weaponizes interminency, an unresolved preponderance of settlers and settlements, really, colonizers and colonies, undeclared borders, de facto annexation against the indigenous population. The Zionist regime's main imperative is to displace no matter the cost. This is why the families of Masafer Yatta need to prove that their home is their home, and why this ostensibly simple, even mundane truth can be so arrogantly delegitimized by the labyrinthine logics of settler colonial law. Yunus' words also capture in exacting detail how the struggle of Palestinians in Masafer Yatta illuminates the overall anti-colonial character of the Palestinian resistance struggle as a whole, Nakba after Nakba. So long as Zionism, the Zionist regime's ideology, exists, it will continue to mean an alternating dance between colonial violence and the reactionary settler laws that justify it. And of course, there is the settler, the glorified squatter, the would-be colonizer fully supported and enabled by the fake regime of Israel, which in turn was founded by and is sustained through the very acts of violent theft, appropriation, and racist dehumanization of this figure represents. What began as an apparent exception is inevitably codified into general policy by a settler colonial regime. Organizers and activists remain acutely aware that there is an added layer of cruelty in addition to the colonial process of expulsion from Masafer Yatar. As activist Hamdan Muhammad Al-Horeini has explained, it's not really about destroying the houses, it's about destroying the life. If the area can be entirely depopulated, the time during which Palestinians lived there can in turn be erased. This allows the Zionist regime's colonial repurposing to eventually be confirmed by a surface reality made possible by ethnic cleansing. Then there will be no sense of time, no possibility of history outside of the colonizer's claims. Indeed, to be Palestinian living in the extended present of ongoing Zionist settler colonialism means confronting time on many levels and in many ways. First, naturally, it means to continue finding oneself racing against time, as the Zionist regime and its military steal more land,